The museum itself, it has a kind of a long meandering history. And of course, as any kind of a museum that comes from a very specific colonial history, it would be one that will be colored by the kind of changes that occur. So it was established around 1935. Back then, the university was called University of Malaya. 1955 was a period in which Singapore is undergoing forms of decolonization in a way, with many responses and competing interests to what Singapore may mean as a kind of independent or post-colonial entity.
People generally associate the Chinese collection with the collection that came from the Nanyang University. That came over to Kent Ridge when the Nanyang University and University of Singapore merged in 1980 to form the NUS. But prior to that merger, actually in the University of Malaya and Singapore Gallery, there had already been a small Chinese collection. What is interesting is that when Michael Sullivan was collecting for the Chinese collection, he said that, oh, China is close to the rest of the world and I cannot acquire Chinese things. But at the same time, when the Nanyang University in the 1950s, around the same time, was beginning to be built, Chinese collectors were already giving their artworks. So what accounts for that actually is that they were moving in different circles. The kind of Chinese people that the Western educated and the colonial officials were hanging around was very different from the Chinese network of businessmen and collectors who were collecting Chinese things. So when the two universities merged in 1980s, the Nanyang University collection came over to NUS, and that forms the bulk of the collection, and we continued to collect since 1980 in the name of the Lee Kong Chin Art Gallery.
It's a space for us to continuously sort of incubate certain ideas and sort of experiment with curatorial methods that we have not tried with and would like to play around. So it's a space that really accommodates potentials and even potential failures. So, because some of the projects that we do here may not eventuate to big scale exhibitions, but we like to keep them sort of incubated for a while, and maybe along the way, like any good researcher, you know, sometimes there are trajectories that you pursue and then you find that it's not going anywhere and you abandon it maybe for greener pastures or something else. And this is a space for us to sort of enact a similar sort of enterprise. On our own. And currently in this space right now is, sorry about the audio, I mean it's I'll explain it in a bit, but
We have a little bit of everything. We of course don't have the kinds of grand treasures, you know, in the kind of numbers that Chinese museums in the mainland have, but we have very early Neolithic Warring State kind of jades and bronzes, archaeological stones and axes. So in terms of the ranges, we don't have many very early bronzes, but it's enough for us to be able to tell the story of a shift in ideology around after the Warring States period to a time where, because of Confucianism, things became simpler, and so bronzes were also a lot more simpler in their ornamentation. And that's good for Chinese studies students to be able to we can, you know, illustrate to them what shifts in ideology mean in terms of material culture. Mm-hmm. But then we also have very ornate kind of bronze ornaments and accessories that reflect wealth and status as well. Mm-hmm. Then this gallery is then divided into kind of two types of materials. On the one hand, we have ceramics, and our ceramics are displayed in a chronological order from the very early archaeological types of ceramics. We don't have very many, but we have some very good representative pieces of archaeological ceramics. But when we look at the ceramics, we are able to then document to them that actually when we look at the rise and fall of kilns in different places, not only are we able to tell the story of the experimentation of Chinese glazes and ceramics, but we're also able to touch into the disruptions in Chinese history, regional history, political history a little bit. And so that's the ceramics. Ceramics being experimentation of glazes, and a lot of people think that by the time of the Song Dynasty, The Song Dynasty glazes were the epitome of that glaze experimentation, which is, you know, all fine and good. And because the blue and whites become, you know, so important to the rest of the world, you know, Persia and China, you know, at one time being synonymous with fine ceramics. By the 15th century, 16th century, when the European ships were able to come to the southern kilns, this is where a lot of these fine export ceramics were created. And what's interesting is that shapes like this candy or larger dishes and the decoration, these aren't typically to domestic Chinese tastes. And so these are shipwreck wares, and some of these are borrowed from the, Asian Civilization Museum. Mm-hmm. And we also had some pieces that we borrowed from the recent Belitung cargo excavation. But it indicates that as early as the 9th century, maritime trade between China and Southeast Asia existed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we are able then to, you know, compare the archaeological with the connoisseurial. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it raises questions of, you know, what becomes collectible and then what becomes, you know, artifactual. This site is a permanent collection, and on the other side it's actually a temporary space. And usually we try to let the temporary exhibitions dialogue and contrast with the each other. So the classical versus the contemporary. And in a way, using that kind of dialogue or sometimes even debate and clash, you know, to bring up questions about, you know, continuity and disruptions. We then have also lined up chronologically the narrative about the developments of Chinese ink. Even though our Chinese ink collection dates mainly from the Qing Dynasty, what is really good is that in the Qing Dynasty, there was a lot of cultural reflection into the golden past, and people were looking into seal carving, rock inscriptions, and so we're able to use that to make a link with earlier dynasties as well. So it makes very good teaching references for the Chinese studies classes here, to be able to tell them not only about the progression of Chinese ink painting, but also what they were referring to when we look at classical Chinese culture and classical civilizations. Narratively, we are able to tell the story about how Chinese paintings move from a scholarly and courtly kind of patronage into a rising middle class kind of consumption, where the rise of the celebrity painters emerge, and we are able to then talk a little bit about the modernization of Chinese ink around the time of the modernization of Chinese culture in Republican times from 1911 onwards. Then this side of the wall ends off in a way at in the 1930s, because after 1949 China falls, or rather China becomes communist. And China becomes communist, and ink painting suffers a kind of demise, because at that point in time during the Cultural Revolution, if you were doing ink works, either you were bourgeois or you were feudal. And so it was not easy to find works of art and ink until the later part of the Cultural Revolution. But what we then have on the other side of the wall is where overseas Chinese ink painting picks up that slack and has a new development. So here is where we are able to talk a little bit about the contributions of overseas Chinese communities to the development of an extension of Chinese culture. So while ink production kind of suffers a temporary halt in China, here in this region, educated people or people who had a hobby for the ink arts continued to make works of art. There was also some kind of evolution and a mix of using ink principles and traditions onto local landscapes. So here is where we see a fusion of the local as well as the tradition. China as well then, that interaction between Chinese ink and global art movements arise in, you know, interesting fusion pieces like this one, where it's an ink work but it's composed in cubist kind of principles, geometrical, and in the 1970s, a group of artists in Hong Kong that formed the One Art Group were able to experiment in very avant-garde-ish kind of ways, in a way that's not possible in China. So in this narrative, we're able to then bring students up to date about contemporary ink development in Asia, in Singapore as well, ending it off there. And so in the same way that ink painting wall has some kind of a separation.
So what the collection was formed around was the idea that Singapore should have its own identity within the moment in which it could attain its self-rule or independence. So around 1955, I think the kind of projection about culture had been defined very much in terms of Singapore being an immigrant society and having its foundations in the mother cultures of India, China, and of course Southeast Asia and the Islamic world. And therefore the core collection that was put together was informed by this idea about culture, what Singaporean culture could be. So the initial collections were forged around those themes: Chinese art, Indian art, Southeast Asian and Malay art in particular, and Islamic art. And the museum began its collecting around 1954.
So along the way, you'll see a lot of little snippets, selected excerpts from the exhibitions themselves in the form of objects, some objects that we've kept in our collection and we sort of want to represent them here, as well as excerpts from the exhibition's wall text itself. A lot of the catalogs and publications, the essays that we've written, we kind of sort of excerpted them and to create what we would call, I guess, a sort of exhibitionary montage of all the different things that would come in and, you know, rub against each other. I'll just point out this particular project is Objectum, produced in late 2012 and early 2013, which is roughly the time that I came in as well. And this is a project by curatorial interns that I was a part of. I wasn't in this group in particular, but I know very well the people who work on this project. As part of Curating Lab, which is a curatorial intensive program that we run in 2012 and most recently in 2014, groups of us have to come up with exhibition proposals and do a sort of show together. And this group in particular, you know, they want to look at this curator called Ken Chong, who was once with the Singapore Historical Museum, now National Museum. But he was working there as a curator and he was collecting all these artifacts from yesteryears because he was interested in all these sort of kitschy, popular, everyday objects. And, you know, he was collecting them because he felt like as a national museum, as a national entity, one should be actually doing these things. But of course, a lot of his colleagues didn't see the value.
So these are artworks done by different groups of artists, showing, you know, that the amateur groups of artists that were being formed here in the Singapore Art Society, and then different exhibition venues. This drawing is very interesting because we went to do research and we found out now that in around 1953-54, it was censored from the Young Men's Christian Association exhibition for being too graphic. And how it came into the museum was that it's noted in the newspaper that Malcolm MacDonald, the Governor General, acquired the piece. And later on, when he left, he gave the University of Malaya his collection of artworks, and so that's how it came in here. So, you know, actually pretty exciting times for a place that people thought was a cultural desert. In the 50s, when talks of independence was being debated or being proposed, the Chinese educated students were very, very concerned because they saw this as an extension of imperialist and colonialist kind of plans, because the independence plans came from the British. They disagreed with the cultural and language policies and the education policies. and they felt that, you know, Western ideas and Western cultures continued to spread injustice. And so amongst that group of Chinese students who identified as social realists, their artworks produced is, you know, often about, you know, social tensions, poverty, student movement, solidarity. And so, yes, but since then things haven't got as exciting. and, you know, this group of portraits is, and still life is interesting. It's done by a group of students called that form the Equator Art Society. And, you know, very, as a shorthand in Singapore art history, people call them leftist artists. But the point here is that they actually were also a group that came together to practice still life and drawing techniques. And so it's actually very academic what they were doing.
By 1962, an interesting thing happened. The university decided that it should split. Part of the university shall go to Kuala Lumpur and part will be here, remaining in Singapore. So what they have done is to identify collections that will stay and collections that will go eventually to Kuala Lumpur. And it took a long time, of course. In the intervening period, Singapore separated from Malaysia, and by 1973, part of the collection is now in Kuala Lumpur. So it's an interesting history. So if you go to Kuala Lumpur, you go to University of Malaya, University or Museum of Asian Art, you will see part of the original collection there. So that's the basic history, which is an interesting one. And it defines itself in terms of a kind of a colonial phase leading towards an independent phase. And it can also be seen as a kind of prototypal modern art museum because they were interested in looking at how the cultures, as I mentioned before, actually interacted and produced a kind of hybridized, if not with a form of inter-exchange ideas about aesthetics and perhaps in relation to the context of modernizing Asia and westernizing Singapore. So it's kind of a very interesting attempt to create also a kind of a prototypal notion of what a modern art museum can look like.
So in a sense, we want to start off also on the idea of objects. When and where do they accrue value, and what sort of value dependent on the context itself? So we kind of this exhibition starts on that. So as I was saying just now, when exhibitions meet each other, there are moments like these that actually happen, where we will get textual excerpts from both shows, and you see the way that they're kind of aligned, right and left aligned. That's the point of meeting, because this is really where this begins and that begins. So this becomes a strategy for us to link, and you see that replicated in points in the space itself, where exhibits sort of meet each other.
When we talk about the localization of Singaporean and Malaysian art, people often refer to the field trip taken by the four pioneer artists, Liu Kang, Chen Chong Sui, Cheong Soo Ping, and Chen Wenxi. They went to Bali in 1954, and people refer to that as the turning point where people decided to look for local flavors, but effectively, well, they were influenced by Gauguin, yeah. You come into France to study, and it was the kind of Atelier style, studio style. What we found when we looked at the artworks around was that Bali was an exciting point of time, it was an exciting moment, but around the time of Bali, they were already looking around them in Malaysia at the different communities for local elements and local subject matters, you know, so landscapes, and then, you know, the portrayal of local activities and local women. But then as time moved on, instantly forward, you know, 10 years later, the younger group of artists then turned that observation back to Southeast Asia, coinciding actually with, you know, how Singapore is confidently wanting to establish and taking the lead in Southeast Asia. That economic drive, like I said, you know, opens opportunities for people to follow in that footstep. So some of our younger artists were able to take advantage of that kind of regional networks, and then went out to Angkor, to Bali, and they had their field trips. And what is interesting is that in this moment, there was a kind of a fusion of a very realist kind of observation, and yet it's even a very modernist kind of expression. And this time in the early 60s, late 50s, our young artists were already beginning to be aware that beyond realism and academic studio artworks, investment was something new was happening. And so, going to New York, going to London to learn from these new experimental kind of abstraction.
The most important thing to me is that there's this very nuanced approach to the question of nation. And that's very interesting amongst Singaporean artists. You go to see an Indian exhibition by Indian contemporary artists, it is solidly informed by this broader idea of what constitutes an Indian culture, if not nation. The same with Filipino artists, Indonesian artists, the question of what constitutes nation and society is important. But Singapore, I think that Singapore artists, in a way, it is a certain kind of values that are not necessarily defined by this conditionality of nation, but rather a certain sense of being able to participate in a kind of a global interest without having to be too rooted in this question of what a nation is all about. And you can see that continuity occurs from a prototypal museum like the University Museum in 1955 to the formation of the National Heritage Board in 1993 in Singapore, and eventually a formulation of cluster museums. You have the History Museum, which looks very specifically into social history. You have the Asian Civilization Museum, which specifically look into these three mother cultures. And of course, you have the Singapore Art Museum, in 1993, which looked into the very condition of modernity and what are the consequences in terms of our values into aesthetics and our interest towards modern art. So it was very much to be seen in culture of continuities and within the context of change that had taken place. And of course, for the longest time, it's about the question of what constitutes the Singaporean modern identity. And more it becomes the question of what constitutes a vibrant city urban culture today.